We continue now with the encyclical of Pope Pius IX on the Church in Armenia, dated January 6, 1873. Authority of the Papacy. This fact was well known to the illustrious bishops of the Eastern Churches. Hence, at the Council of Constantinople, held in the year 536, Menas, the bishop of that city, affirmed openly with the approval of the fathers, "We follow and obey the apostolic see, as your charity realizes, and we consider those in communion with it to be in communion with us, and we too condemn the men condemned by it." Even more clearly and emphatically, St. Maximus, abbot of Chrysopolis, and a confessor of the faith, in referring to Pyrrhus the Monothelite, declared, "If he wants neither to be nor to be called a heretic, he does not need to satisfy random individuals of his orthodoxy, for this is excessive and unreasonable." But just as all men have been scandalized at him since the chief man was scandalized, so also when that one has been satisfied, all men will doubtless be satisfied. He should hasten to satisfy the Roman see before all others. For when this see has been satisfied, all men everywhere will join in declaring him pious and orthodox. For that man wastes his words who thinks that men like me must be persuaded and beguiled when he has not yet satisfied and beseeched the blessed Pope of the Holy Roman Church. From the incarnate word of God himself, as well as from the conclusions and sacred canons of all holy councils, the apostolic see has been granted the command, authority, and power of binding and loosing for all God's holy churches in the entire world. For this reason, John, Bishop of Constantinople, solemnly declared, and the entire 8th Ecumenical Council did so later, that the names of those who were separated from communion with the Catholic Church, that is, of those who did not agree in all matters with the Apostolic See, are not to be read out during the sacred mysteries. This plainly meant that they did not recognize those men as true Catholics. All these traditions dictate that whoever the Roman Pontiff judges to be a schismatic for not expressly admitting and reverencing his power must stop calling himself Catholic. Since this does not please the neo-schismatics, they follow the example of heretics of more recent times. They argue that the sentence of schism and excommunication pronounced against them by the Archbishop of Tyana, the apostolic delegate in Constantinople, was unjust and consequently void of strength and influence. They have claimed also that they are unable to accept the sentence because the faithful might desert to the heretics if deprived of their ministration. These novel arguments were wholly unknown and unheard of by the ancient fathers of the Church, for the whole Church throughout the world knows that the see of the blessed Apostle Peter has the right of loosing again what any pontiffs have bound, since this see possesses the right of judging the whole Church, and no one else may judge its judgment. The Jansenist heretics dared to teach such doctrines as that an excommunication pronounced by a lawful prelate could be ignored on a pretext of injustice. Each person should perform, as they said, his own particular duty despite an excommunication. Our predecessor of happy memory, Clement IX, in his Constitution Unigenitus against the errors of Quesnel, forbade and condemned statements of this kind. These statements were scarcely in any way different from some of John Wycliffe's which had previously been condemned by the Council of Constance and Martin V. Through human weakness, a person could be unjustly punished with censure by his prelate. But it is still necessary, as our predecessor, St. Gregory the Great, warned, for a bishop's subordinates to fear even an unjust condemnation, and not to blame the judgment of the bishop rashly, in case the fault which did not exist, since the condemnation was unjust, develops out of the pride of heated reproof. But if one should be afraid even of an unjust condemnation by one's bishop, what must be said of those men who have been condemned for rebelling against their bishop and this apostolic see, and tearing to pieces, as they are now doing, by a new schism, the seamless garment of Christ, which is the Church. The charity which obliges priests in particular to attend to the faithful should derive from a pure heart and a good conscience, and faith unfeigned, as the Apostle warned. In reviewing the qualities which we ought to display as ministers of God, he also included in charity unfeigned in the word of truth. But Christ himself, however, the God who is charity, openly declared that those who do not listen to the church should be regarded as Gentiles and publicans. And our predecessors, St. Gelasius, answered Euphemius, Bishop of Constantinople, when he stated that the flock ought to follow the shepherd who calls them back to safe pastures, rather than the shepherd follow the flock as it wanders off the road. For the people must be taught, not followed, and if they do not know, we must impress on them what is permitted and not permitted, rather than give them our approval. Definition of a schismatic. But the neo-schismatics say that it was not a case of doctrine, but of discipline. So the name and prerogatives of Catholics cannot be denied to those who object. Our Constitution Reversarus, published on July 12, 1867, answers this objection. We do not doubt that you know well how vain and worthless this evasion is. For the Catholic Church has always regarded as schismatic those who obstinately oppose the lawful prelates of the Church, and in particular, the chief shepherd of all. Schismatics avoid carrying out their orders, and even deny their very rank. Since the faction from Armenia is like this, they are schismatics, even if they had not been condemned as such by apostolic authority. For the Church consists of the people in union with the priest, and the flock following its shepherd. Consequently, the bishop is in the Church, and the Church in the bishop, and whoever is not with the bishop is not in the Church. Furthermore, our predecessor, Pius VI, warned in his apostolic letter, condemning the civil constitution of the clergy in France, discipline is often closely related to doctrine, and has a great influence in preserving its purity. In fact, in many instances, the holy councils have unhesitatingly cut off from the Church, by their anathema, those who have infringed its discipline. Authority of the Holy See. But the neo-schismatics have gone further, since every schism fabricates a heresy for itself to justify its withdrawal from the Church. Indeed, they have even accused this apostolic see as well, as if we had exceeded the limits of our power in commanding that certain points of discipline were to be observed in the Patriarchate of Armenia. Nor can the Eastern churches preserve communion and unity of faith with us without being subject to the apostolic power in matters of discipline. Teaching of this kind is heretical, and not just since the definition of the power and nature of the papal primacy was determined by the Ecumenical Vatican Council. The Catholic Church has always considered it such, and abhorred it. Thus the bishops at the Ecumenical Council of Chalcedon clearly declared the supreme authority of the Apostolic See in their proceedings. Then they humbly requested from our predecessor, St. Leo, confirmation and support for their decrees, even those which concerned discipline. Indeed, the successor of Blessed Peter, by the very fact that he is such, has been assigned the whole flock of Christ, so that together with his bishopric he receives the power of universal rule. Then the other bishops must be assigned their portions of the flock, so that they can rule over their flock. If the supreme authority of this assignment to Blessed Peter and his successors is rejected, the very foundations and prerogatives of the patriarchal churches in particular would be shaken. Even if Christ willed that Peter and the other leaders have something in common, the other leaders have this only through Peter. And in fact, Peter himself honored the See of Alexandria when he sent his disciple, the evangelist. He strengthened the See of Antioch, which he occupied for 7 years, even though he was going to leave it. And both Anatolius, Bishop of Constantinople, and Marcion, the emperor, openly acknowledged that the approval and confirmation of the Apostolic See was altogether necessary to the decrees of the Council of Chalcedon concerning the See of Constantinople. Accordingly, then, unless they abandon the unchanging and unbroken tradition of the Church, which is so clearly confirmed by testimonies of the Fathers, the neo-schismatics can in no way convince themselves that they are Catholics, even if they declare themselves such. If we did not thoroughly know the clever and subtle deceits of heretics, it would be incomprehensible that the Ottoman regime still regards as Catholics people it knows to be cut off from the Catholic Church by our judgment and authority. For if the Catholic religion is to continue safe and free in the Ottoman dominion, as the emperor has decreed, then the essence of this religion should also be allowed, for instance, the primacy of jurisdiction of the Roman pontiff. Most men feel that the Church's supreme head and shepherd should decide who are Catholics and who are not. False accusations. But the neo-schismatics declare that they do not oppose the Catholic Church's principles in the least. Their sole aim is to protect the rights of their churches and their nation, and even the rights of their supreme emperor. They falsely allege that we have infringed these rights. By this means, they fearlessly make us responsible for the present disorder. Exactly in this way did the Acacian schismatics act towards our predecessor, Saint Gelasius. And previously, the Arians falsely accused Liberius, also our predecessor, to the Emperor Constantine, because Liberius refused to condemn Saint Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, and refused to support their heresy. For as the same holy pontiff Gelasius wrote to the Emperor Athanasius on this matter, a frequent characteristic of sick people is to reproach the doctors who recall them to health by appropriate measures rather than agree to desist from and condemn their own harmful desires. These appear to be the main grounds on which the neo-schismatics gain their support and solicit the patronage of powerful men for their cause, most wicked as it is. Lest the faithful be led into error, we must deal with these grounds more fully than if we merely had to refute unjust accusations. We do not wish to recall that after the schism succeeded, the fortunes of the Eastern Catholic Churches declined. Then God overthrew the empire of the Greeks in punishment for the sundered unity of His Church. Neither do we desire to recall the energetic efforts of our predecessors, as soon as it was possible, to call back the straying sheep to the one true flock of Christ the Lord. But even if the results did not fully match the efforts expended, still, by God's mercy, some churches of the different rites did return to the truth and Catholic unity of the Church. These the Apostolic See received in its arms like newborn infants, and took particular care to strengthen them in the true Catholic faith, and to keep them completely free from all stain of heresy. Schism at the time of Pius VII. When it was reported that the evil doctrines of a sect that Pope Pius VII had already condemned were being spread in the East, Pius VII became alarmed. Because they were trying to suppress the primacy of papal jurisdiction, the Pope decided on immediate measures to prevent their futile ambiguities and contentions from deceiving the faithful. Accordingly, he ordered the ancient formula of Saint Hormestas, our predecessor, to be sent to the patriarchs and eastern bishops. In addition, he commanded each within his jurisdiction to have every present or future clergyman subscribe to the profession of faith prescribed for men of the East by Urban VIII, unless they had already done so. Continuation of schisms. However, soon afterwards, in the year 1806, the so-called Antioch Synod met at the monastery of Carcafa in the Diocese of Beirut. The Pistoian Synod, which had already been condemned, quietly and deceitfully influenced the Synod in many matters. This Synod reproduced several statements, in part verbatim, and in part ambiguously expressed, even though these had been condemned by the Holy Roman See. Still other statements smacked of Baianism and Jansenism and disturbed the position of the Church by their opposition to ecclesiastical power, sound doctrine, and the approved discipline of the Church. This Synod of Carcafa published its decrees in Arabic in 1810 without reference to the Apostolic See. As a result, it occasioned complaints from many bishops and was finally censured and condemned in an apostolic letter by Gregory the 16th. He bade the bishops derive the norm of their rule and teaching from the other ancient councils long approved by the Apostolic See. If only the errors in which it abounded had come to an end when the Synod was condemned. But such wicked teachings did not cease to creep secretly throughout the East, waiting for the right moment to emerge into common view. Despite an unsuccessful attempt about 20 years ago, the new Armenian schismatics have now daringly brought this about. Catholicism in Constantinople. But since discipline is the rampart of faith, the Apostolic See needed to restore the discipline. It has certainly never abandoned this most serious duty, even in adverse times, when it could attend only to transitory needs while it awaited more the favorable times. The Ottoman Emperor, at the insistence of Leo XII and Pius VIII, and relying on the support of the Catholic rulers of Austria and France, recognized the distinction which exists between Catholics and heretics. Therefore, he removed Catholics from the civil power of the latter, decreeing that Catholics should have had their own head or prefect. It was only then in Constantinople that bishops of the Armenian Rite could safely exercise the authority of an ordinary to raise Catholic churches of the same rite and to profess and practice openly the Catholic religion. Accordingly, Pius VIII set up at Constantinople the See of the Primate and Archbishop of the Armenians. The Pope was eager that canonical discipline should thrive there in a suitable and timely manner. After some years, as soon as it was clearly expedient, we set up episcopal sees subject to the Primate at Constantinople, and also prescribed the procedure to be observed for the election of bishops. Finally, in an imperial document issued on April 7, 1857, to our venerable brother Anthony Hassoun, then the primate of that see, provision was made on the authority of the Supreme Emperor of the Ottoman Empire to prevent the power of the civil prefect, as he is called, from being exercised in religious affairs, which would be completely at variance with the laws of the Catholic Church. The Armenians themselves requested that we unite the primatial church at Constantinople to the patriarchal see of Cilicia. We did this, and we abrogated the title of the former by our apostolic letter, Reversarus. Then we decided that it was both timely and necessary to sanction certain chief points of discipline by the authority of the same constitution. We commanded by our apostolic letter, Commissum, of July 12, 1867, that a patriarchal synod be held as soon as possible, in order to carefully ensure that an exact order of discipline be correctly established in the whole Armenian Patriarchate. But an enemy proceeded to sow weeds in the Armenian church at Constantinople, when shortly afterwards some men raised the question about the civil prefecture of the Armenian community, which they complained had been stolen by the new patriarch. A serious disturbance soon followed this controversy. The same patriarch was accused of betraying the rights of the state in accepting our previously mentioned constitution, as a Catholic bishop was bound to do. In this way, at last, all the plans, artifices, and abuse of the dissidents have come to bear on this particular constitution. In this affair, two points in particular have been called criminal. That is, the decrees concerning the election of holy bishops and the administration of the church's property. For it has been falsely asserted that these are opposed to the national laws and the laws of the supreme emperor. Although our prescription on each of these headings ought to be very well known, it is well to repeat them at this point. For many speak as if they understand, in spite of their ignorance, of what is in our prescriptions, and others, like soothsayers and interpreters of dreams, judge what they do not know. Selection of hierarchy. We commanded that a synod composed exclusively of bishops elect the patriarch. However, we forbade the man elected to be enthroned until he received a letter of confirmation from the Apostolic See. We ordered bishops to be elected in the following way. All the bishops of the province were to gather in a synod and recommend 3 suitable churchmen to the Apostolic See. If it were not possible for all the bishops to come to the synod, the recommendation could be made by a synod of at least 3 diocesan bishops, together with the patriarch, if those absent indicated their triple recommendation in writing. When this is done, the Roman pontiff will choose 1 of those recommended and put him in charge of the vacant see. We declared that we were certain that the bishops would recommend worthy and suitable men, so that we would never have to select someone different from those recommended to be in charge of the vacant see. If you consider these measures with a mind free from the passions of faction, you will find them all sanctioned by the universal sense of the canons. Concerning the exclusion of the laity from the election of bishops, a clear distinction must be made, lest a doctrine at variance with the Catholic faith result. This distinction is between the right to elect bishops and the ability to give testimony as to their life and morals. The former claim must be credited to the wrong notions of Luther and Calvin, who even asserted that it was a matter of divine law that the bishop should be elected by the people. As everybody realizes, such false teaching has been and is still rejected by the Catholic Church. For no power of electing bishops or other ministers of religion has ever been given to the people by either divine or ecclesiastical law. Testimony of the people concerning the life and morals of those who are to be raised to the episcopate became important when the Arians, to whom the Emperor Constantius was partial, began to eject Catholic prelates from their sees and replace them with adherents of Arianism, as St. Athanasian's Lament. The people felt that if they were present and if their testimony were heard at the election of bishops, then they would be more likely to support and help them. That custom indeed lasted for some time in the church, but when recurrent discord, disturbance, and other abuses resulted from it, it was necessary to remove the people from the process. For as St. Jerome observes, sometimes the judgment of the ordinary people is wrong, and in approving of priests each man is partial to his own ways and seeks a superior who resembles himself rather than one who is good. Nevertheless, in imposing a procedure of election, we left the Synod of Bishops freedom to examine the talents of the men to be elected in whatever way they preferred, even to the extent of summoning the testimony of the people if they so chose. And, in fact, since the publication of our Constitution, such an examination was conducted 3 years ago by the Armenian prelates, when a bishop was elected for the districts of Sebaste and Tokay. The proceedings sent to this Holy See testified to this. However, we did not, nor do we think it fitting, to impose a similar procedure in the election of the Patriarch for several reasons. In the first place, his rank is so high. Secondly, he is in charge of all the bishops in his district. And lastly, it is clear to us that only bishops have taken part in the election of the Patriarch in each of the Eastern Rites, except on particular and extraordinary occasions when circumstances demanded a different procedure. For instance, when the Catholics were protecting themselves against the strong power of the schismatics to whom they were subjected, they asked for a different patriarch for themselves. By this fact, they ensured their separation from these schismatics and their true and sincere conversion to the Catholic faith, as indeed happened when Abraham Peter I was elected. However, some resent and bemoan both our declaration that this apostolic see has the right and power to elect a bishop, either from the three names recommended, or apart from them, and our prohibition against the enthronement of an elected patriarch without our prior confirmation. They call our attention to the customs and canons of their churches as if we had abandoned the provisions of the sacred canons. We might respond to these men in the same way our predecessor, St. Gelasius, did when the Acacian schismatics brought the same false accusation against him. They cite the canons against us without knowing what they're saying, since they show that they are themselves in opposition to the canons by the very fact that they deny obedience to the first see, although its advice is sound and correct. For these are the very canons which recognize the full divine authority of the Blessed Peter over the whole church. Indeed, they proclaim that he lives and exercises judgment in his successors to the present time and forever, as the Council of Ephesus affirmed. Rightly then did Stephen, Bishop of Larissa, give this firm answer to those who considered that the privileges of the churches of Constantinople were somewhat diminished by the intervention of the Roman Pontiff. The authority of the Apostolic See, which was given by God and our Savior to the chief of the apostles, extends the privileges of all the holy churches. In acknowledging this, all the churches of the world should cease their opposition. Certainly, if you recall the history of your districts, you will find examples of Roman pontiffs who used this power when they judged it necessary for the safety of the Eastern churches. This is why the Roman pontiff Agapetus used his authority to eject Anthemus from the See of Constantinople and replaced him with Menas without calling a synod. Our predecessor, Martin I, entrusted his power for the East to John, Bishop of Philadelphia, in regard to the regions of the East. He instructed him by the apostolic authority given to us by the Lord through the Most Holy Peter, Prince of the Apostles, to appoint bishops, priests, and deacons in every city subject to the sees of Jerusalem and Antioch. In more recent times, you will recall that the Bishop of Mardin of the Armenians was elected and consecrated by the authority of this apostolic see, even though our predecessors granted the care of this see to the patriarchs of Cilicia. This was granted when the administration of the district of Mesopotamia was assigned to them by the Holy See. All these actions agree with the supreme power of the Roman See. The Church of the Armenians has always recognized, proclaimed, and respected this, except during unhappy times of schism. This is not surprising, since even among your people still separated from the Catholic faith, the ancient tradition remains strong that the great bishop and martyr whom you regard as the enlightener of your race received his power from the apostolic see. He came to the see in person, undeterred by the length and great hardship of the journey. This was Gregory, whom Chrysostom described as a sun rising in the eastern regions, whose shining rays reached as far as the Greek people. We decided on this arrangement by ourselves after carefully studying both on ancient and recent events. Everyone knows that the eternal and at times the temporal happiness of people depends on the proper election of bishops. The circumstances of time and place must be considered, referring all the authority for selecting the bishops to the apostolic see. Still, we decided to moderate the exercise of this power by allowing the synod of bishops to elect the patriarch and by having this synod recommend 3 suitable men to us for vacancies as was sanctioned in our constitution. But on this matter too, to rouse the torpid and increasingly inspire those who are running well, we said that we hope truly suitable men worthy of so important an office would be recommended to avoid the necessity of our ever having to appoint to a vacancy someone apart from those recommended. This was provided for also in the procedure we established in 1853 for exactly the same purpose. We have heard that some have interpreted these otherwise mild words to mean that we would disregard and even deride the recommendations of the Synod. Others have gone even further and developed the theory that a proposal to entrust the care of the Armenians to Latin bishops is veiled in these words. Such foolish accusations indeed deserve no answer, for only fearful and foolish men could utter such statements. But we considered that we should not keep silence on our right to elect a bishop apart from the 3 recommended candidates, in case the apostolic see should be compelled to exercise this right in the future. But even if we had remained silent, this right and duty of the see of Blessed Peter would have remained unimpaired. For the rights and privileges given to the see by Christ himself, while they may be attacked, cannot be destroyed. No man has the power to renounce a divine right which he might at some time be compelled to exercise by the will of God himself. Although it is now 19 years since these pronouncements were made to the Armenians, and although bishops have been elected many times, we have never used that power, not even when recently, after the publication of the Constitution Reversaris, we received a triple recommendation from which we could not elect a bishop. In this case, we told the Synod of Bishops to recommence the process of recommendation in accordance with the laws we prescribed, rather than our electing a bishop apart from their recommendations. This has been hindered so far by the new schism which has begun to tear apart the Church of the Armenians. We are confident, furthermore, that such distressful times will never befall the Catholic Churches of Armenia as to compel the Roman pontiffs to impose bishops on them who have not been recommended by the Synod of Bishops. We will add some remarks on our prohibition of the enthronement of patriarchs before Holy See. The writings of the ancient testify that the election of patriarchs had never been considered definite and valid without the agreement and confirmation of the Roman pontiff. Accordingly, it is learned, those elected to patriarchal sees always sought such confirmation with the support of the emperors. Thus, to pass over other names in a well-known affair, Anatolius, Bishop of Constantinople, a man who certainly did not serve the apostolic see very well, and even Photius himself, the first cause of the Greek schism, requested the Roman pontiff to confirm their elections by his consent. To this end, they employed the intervention of the emperors Theodosius, Michael, and Basil. For this reason, the fathers of Chalcedon, even though they declared all the acts of the robber synod of Ephesus invalid, willed that Maximus, bishops of Antioch, remain in the see. He had replaced Domnus by authority of that synod, since the holy and blessed Pope who confirmed the holy and venerable Maximus as bishop of the Church of Antioch appeared to have approved his merit in a just judgment. But if you consider the patriarchs of those churches which in more recent times have renounced schism and returned to Catholic unity, you will find that all of them ask for confirmation from the Roman pontiff. The Roman pontiffs confirmed them all by letter in such a way that at the same time the pontiffs appointed them and placed them over their churches. The Apostolic See has at times tolerated elected patriarchs using their power before being confirmed by the See. It has done so because their districts were so distant, or because the journey was dangerous, or because of the reverses threatening more and more frequently from the predominance of schismatics of the same rite. This dispensation has been granted, even in the West, to those who are very far away, because of the needs and benefits of the churches. But it is fair to remind you that such reasons are no longer valid, since travel is much easier, and since the Catholics have been delivered from the civil power of the schismatics by the kindness of the supreme Ottoman emperor. By following this procedure, safe provision is made for the preservation of the Catholic faith, which could be disturbed at will by one who is unworthy of such high office, occupying the patriarchal see before the apostolic confirmation, which might arise when an elected patriarch is rejected by the Holy Apostolic See and has to relinquish his place, will be forestalled. Everything which is sanctioned in our Constitution contributes to the preservation and development of the Catholic faith. It contributes as well to the protection of the real liberty of the Church and the authority of the bishops, whose rights and privileges find strength and repose in the stability of the Apostolic See. The Roman pontiffs have always strongly defended these rights and privileges from heretics and ambitious men at the request of bishops of every rank, nation, and right. Ecclesiastical laws. We do not need to give a long answer to the question of the so-called national laws, for if it is in a matter of civil laws only, the supreme ruler has the power to judge and decide whether he deems them useful and beneficial to his subjects. But if it is a matter of ecclesiastical laws, no one can be unaware that Catholics have never recognized any national or popular laws against the Church, its hierarchy, and ordinations. For although peoples and nations have entered the Church from all places, still God has united them all under the supreme shepherd, Blessed Peter, the Prince of the Apostles. Thus there might be no longer be Gentile and Jew, barbarian and Scythian, slave and free, but that Christ may be all things in all men. From him the whole body, joined and knit together by every joint, increases bodily and builds itself up in love. For God has not given any peoples or nations power over the Church, but has entrusted them to the apostles for teaching, and has commanded the duty of belief. For this reason, too, the blessed Peter openly declared at the meeting of apostles and presbyters that God had decreed that the nation should hear the word of the gospel through him and should believe. Calumnies against the Church. But it is also said that we have infringed upon the rights of the supreme emperor. This is a common calumny worn thin by the long use heretics have made of it. The Jews first invented it in opposition to Christ and God. Then pagans very often used it not only before the Roman emperors and heretics, but even before Catholic princes. I could wish they had not brought it forward this time as well. To counter it, St. Jerome wrote that heretics cringe before royal rank and often impute their own pride to kings. Assuming the king did what they do, they accuse holy men and preachers of the faith in his presence and forbid teachers to preach in Israel lest they act contrary to the king's will, arguing that Bethel, the house of God, and the false church is the sanctuary of the king and the temple of the kingdom. It would indeed be quite enough to trample in contemptuous silence on these shameless calumnies, which are so far removed from the teachings, habits, and practices of the Catholic faith. But it is necessary to ensure that the simple and inexperienced do not suffer by wrongly judging us and the Apostolic See as a result of the statement of ill-wishers who, in the course of attacking others, attempt to increase their vices. We will continue with this encyclical on the next tape in this series.